Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the surprise election result in France that has put left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, on top. So who are the left leaders? What do they want? And what does this result mean for French President Emmanuel Macron? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 11th of July, these are our main stories. China fiercely rejects accusations from NATO that it's prolonging Russia's war in Ukraine. Jewish people report a spike in anti-Semitism across the EU since the start of the war in Gaza last October. And more cases of a new strain of Mpox are discovered in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Also in this podcast, why are so many of Nigeria's best and brightest young minds trying to leave? And
I feel confident that if we had to, if there was a problem with the International Space Station, we can get in our spacecraft, undock, talk to our team, and figure out the best way to come home.
The cool, calm astronauts currently stranded in space, but unfazed. China has fiercely rejected NATO leaders' claim that it's enabling Russia's war in Ukraine. It said the NATO gathering meeting in Washington was hyping up Beijing's involvement. The gathering initially focused on NATO members' support for Ukraine, but then moved on to China's role in the conflict, prompting this response from Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jian.
The declaration of the NATO summit exaggerated the tension in the Asia-Pacific region. It was full of Cold War mentality and belligerent rhetoric, and the content related to China was full of bias, smears and provocations. We strongly deplore and resolutely oppose this.
Strong words then from Beijing, but is NATO's criticism justified? A question for our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow.
Well, there is certainly a disconnect between what China says and what it does. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. Firstly, there's trade with Russia. Over the last couple of years since Russia invaded Ukraine, that trade has increased massively. So China is buying oil and gas from Russia and selling it consumer goods, which Western companies no longer want to sell it. Also, dual-use technology. This is technology that can be used for civilian purposes or for military purposes. China sells Russia that kind of technology. Also provides diplomatic support for Russia. So really, it's hard not to come to the conclusion that certainly Russia's war in Ukraine would be a lot more difficult if China was not providing that kind of support. So yes, in that sense, NATO does have some justification.
NATO's also concerned about Taiwan, isn't it? And how is China likely to react to that?
Yeah, NATO is concerned about Taiwan, not because it has any military obligations towards Taiwan. Taiwan isn't a member of NATO, but it fears generally it's an example, China's military pressure on Taiwan, an island it thinks it's its own territory, is another indication of China's assertiveness, its willingness to undermine global order and global rules. And so that's why it's concerned. It's also concerned because any conflict over Taiwan might join the United States, a NATO member. And just to underscore that concern, just in the last 24 hours, China sent 66 warplanes around Taiwan. So it gives you an indication of China's military pressure. It's keeping up on Taiwan. You ask there, how is China likely to react? China doesn't engage with outsiders talking about Taiwan in the least. It considers Taiwan its own territory and doesn't want to engage in any discussion. In fact, it's warned NATO to keep out of East Asia. Interestingly, though, at the same time all this is going on, Chinese troops are in right over in Europe, in Belarus, taking part in a military exercise. So whilst China on one hand is saying keep out of East Asia, it's been involved or getting involved in European affairs. So quite an interesting confluence of events taking place all at the same time.
That was Mickey Bristow. Russia, meanwhile, has reportedly said that Moscow will need to act to contain the very serious threat from NATO. The TASS news agency has quoted the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov saying that the Western military alliance is now fully involved in the conflict over Ukraine. Steve Rosenberg is our Moscow correspondent.
There's no real sense of surprise in Moscow. The Russians had expected the NATO summit to announce more aid, more military assistance for Ukraine, but certainly Russian officials are expressing their anger at what has been announced. Yesterday, the foreign ministry spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, said that Washington heads the gang of war. And today we heard the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, saying Russia's opponents in Europe and America do not support dialogue or peace, and accusing Western leaders of seeking Russia's strategic defeat. Moscow, he said, would respond with coordinated measures to keep NATO in check. Now, this is the official narrative here, right? It has been for some time that Russia is a besieged fortress threatened by all kinds of external forces, enemies abroad who are plotting to destroy the Russian Federation. And this narrative is used regularly here, I would say, to try to rally the Russian people around the government and maintain public support for President Putin. And that includes Putin's decision to invade Ukraine.
And coordinated measures to keep NATO in check, what might those look like?
Well, Mr. Peskov didn't spell those out. He said that Russian officials would study carefully the decisions of the NATO summit and they would reach conclusions and decide what to do. So Russia not actually going into details here. But in recent weeks, certain Russian officials have suggested that Moscow might alter, might tweak its so-called nuclear doctrine. And that sort of lists the occasions in, under which Russia would use nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but Mr. Peskov referred to it again today. I think we'll have to wait and see. It's important to point out as well, Jackie, that NATO insists that it is a defensive alliance, right? That it is simply responding to Russia's actions, because there's no doubt that President Putin's decision to launch that full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago sparked a lot of concern amongst Russia's neighbours and across Europe.
And just finally, Steve, we've also heard some fairly strong words from Dmitry Medvedev about Ukraine and NATO.
Yeah, that's right. Well, if you follow Mr. Medvedev on social media, you know that he quite likes strong words, and he posted today a message saying that Russia should ensure that the irreversible path of Ukraine to NATO ends either with the disappearance of Ukraine or NATO, or better still, both.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. The appeal of one of Russia's most prominent human rights campaigners has been rejected by a court in Moscow. Oleg Orlov was jailed in February for 2.5 years for speaking out against the war in Ukraine. In court today, the 71-year-old said he had no remorse or regrets. Speaking by video link from a prison, Mr. Orlov quoted a prosecutor from the Nuremberg trials of German Nazis to describe Russia's judicial system. It's a fairly scratchy line, but what he's saying is they distorted, perverted, and finally achieved the total destruction of justice and laws. They made the judicial system an indispensable part of the dictatorship. Our Europe editor, Charles Haviland, told us more about Mr. Orlov and why he was jailed.
71 years old, he's an absolutely veteran rights campaigner. Memorial is the name of the group that he headed for two decades. And the clue to that is in the name. It was set up to memorialise and remember the victims of rights repression in Russia, including during the long communist era. But he had also become a more general critic of Vladimir Putin's Russia, criticising, for instance, the situation in the Northern Caucasus, Chechnya, etc. And he was in jail for an article he'd written in French media, as you alluded to, criticising the war in Ukraine, something he said had resulted in the mass killing of civilians, something that Moscow, of course, denies, but also blamed Vladimir Putin for leading Russia into fascism.
Well, his appeal has been rejected. What was said in court?
Well, his remarks in court, we heard from him just then, quoting from the prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials, He also said very defiantly, I do not regret or repent anything. I'm in the right place at the right time, and I'm helping to draw attention to mass repression. And rather humorously, at one point, he suggested that those in the courtroom, while waiting for the judge to come back with the verdict, he said, why don't you go and have a drink for my health once the trial's over? And he said, there is excellent cha-cha at the place across the street, referring to a Georgian type of brandy. So a lot of humour there seemingly a lot of resilience. When he was asked after the verdict if he had understood it by his lawyer, he said, why bother listening to them?
And as far as we know, is this it for him, or are there any more appeals open to him?
I'm sure that if there are lines of appeal open, he will want to appeal. And of course, bear in mind that Kremlin critics have not had an easy time of it recently. Nearly all of them are either jailed or exiled. And just this week, we've been hearing of the situation of Vladimir Kara-Murza, who's serving a longer prison sentence, 25 years, also for what the authorities call discrediting the war in Ukraine. His lawyers say he's in okay health after having been denied access to him for 6 days, and they're very concerned about his health. He says he's now been poisoned twice by the authorities. And of course, everyone remembers the death of Alexei Navalny, who was billed as the chief critic of the Kremlin, died in February in a penal colony in Siberia in very murky circumstances.
That was Charles Haviland. The authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo say that they've detected 25 new cases of a new strain of Mpox following an outbreak in the eastern city of Goma. Congolese officials say there have been more than 11,000 cases of Mpox this year and more than 400 deaths. Neighbouring countries have heightened surveillance at their borders. Our correspondent Richard Kagoe explained why this variant of Mpox is different.
Preliminary analysis that's been done by one of the research institutes that is based in eastern Congo says that the strain, it's difficult to detect initially because most of the carriers are asymptomatic. But the ability for it to spread rapidly, especially within a setup like eastern Congo, where most of the people who have been affected live in crowded camps, you know, hosting thousands and thousands of people who have fled the conflict. So they're indicating so far is the ability for it not to be detected and for it to be spread rapidly.
And given those factors, what can the authorities do about it?
I think at the moment, despite the fact that there have been, you know, vaccines that have been on trial and they're not readily available at the moment because of the challenges that do come with the approval processes, I think what the authorities there can do right now is just to create public awareness and also insist on the improvement of hygiene. I think that would be very critical because a lot of people perhaps then would be carrying the disease and they may not know it from the very onset. And I think that would be very critical in terms of the containment measures.
That was Richard Kagoe. A survey of Jewish people in EU countries has found that they continue to report facing high levels of anti-Semitism. It was carried out by the European Union's Fundamental Rights Agency, and it says anti-Semitism has dramatically worsened since the Hamas attacks on Israel and the start of the war in Gaza last October. Our Vienna correspondent Bethany Bell told us more.
This is a study of 8,000 Jews in 13 countries across the EU, including Germany, France, Austria, Hungary, the countries where there is the largest Jewish populations in the EU. The actual survey took place before the October 7th attacks by Hamas. But even before that, the survey reported that many Jews, 62%, saw the Arab-Israeli conflict as affecting their safety. And the director of the report said that they held consultations with Jewish groups after the October 7th attacks and said that the spillover effect of the conflict of the Middle East was eroding hard-fought rights in tackling anti-Semitism in Europe.
And what sort of examples of anti-Semitism were given in the survey?
96% said that they'd encountered anti-Semitism even before the October 7th attacks. They said that there was a great deal of anti-Semitism, particularly online. 90% of respondents said that they'd encountered anti-Semitism online. About 50% or so had encountered anti-Semitism offline from people that they knew. many people said that they continue to worry for their own safety, over 50% worrying for their own safety and 60% worrying for their family's safety. And that, according to the report, has just increased since the 7th of October attacks, where they said there'd been a dramatic surge in anti-Semitic attacks and in the sense of security concerns among Jewish people in Europe.
That was Bethany Bell in Vienna. Still to come in this podcast.
He can't seem to make the case and get through this noise. And secondly, this issue of diminished capacity is just going to continue.
A US pollster on why he thinks Joe Biden might be off the ballot at November's presidential election. Why are so many of Nigeria's young people trying to leave? It's become so common there's even a word for it, japa. Our reporter, Hannah Gelbart, has been speaking to students in Lagos about what japa means for them and what it means for the country they're trying to leave behind.
What is japa? It's when you try to move out of the country.
Running away when everything else seems to be not working in the community.
If I say I want to japa, I want to leave here. I don't want to be here anymore.
Students here at the University of Lagos are facing a difficult choice, and it can be summed up in that one word, japa. It means to escape, and increasingly, it's become shorthand for leaving Nigeria altogether.
The standard of living here is kind of low, so people believe outside the country is far, far better than those living here. After school, I hope I get there. I japa from this country.
Are there things here that you would want to leave behind?
Insecurity, the state of how it is with electricity. Electricity is not always so great. The economy.
Many of the students and young professionals I've spoken to are considering japa. And last year, Nigeria's Immigration Service issued a record number of passports, 1.9 million. The UK, US and Canada are some of the most popular destinations. And the UK government says the number of Nigerians granted work visas has quadrupled since 2019.
How easy is it to japa once you decide that's what you want to do?
Well, it's not easy. The exchange rate is really hitting on a lot of us. That's going to cost like a lot.
It's expensive to leave, but with the fluctuating naira, it's not cheap to stay either. Aminat is a market stall owner in Lagos.
How much is this cup of your rice?
This used to be like 1.5, even less than that, but now it's 2,200.
The rising prices mean some shops here have had to close down, and the economy is one of the main reasons for japa.
Is it something you've ever thought about?
Yes, several with my family. But even the increase in dollar now affects so many people. You want to japa and the budget is like 17 million.
There are also concerns for those left behind. The bulk of people going are IT and healthcare professionals. The Nigerian Medical Association says at least 50 doctors leave the country every single week. The government says it'll train more people up to fill the gaps. And many of those who japa are determined to come back.
So I want to go and learn more, expand myself and gain financial freedom. Then maybe then come back because I really love this place. I love Nigeria.
Yes, I will surely come back because I'm here. I was born and brought up here. I'm proud to be a Nigerian.
Students in Lagos speaking to Hannah Gelbart. There's been a huge focus on President Biden in the last few days as calls for him to stand down as the Democratic Party candidate in November's presidential race grow. Film star Michael Douglas has added his voice to those urging the 81-year-old to step aside. His comments came after actor and fundraiser George Clooney called for a fresh face to challenge for the top job at the upcoming election. So what are the odds that might happen? My colleague Catherine Bjarahanga put that to the US pollster and author John Zogby.
He does very well in a scripted situation, very forceful in his two State of the Union messages and very forceful opening of the NATO summit. So he has that capacity. It's when he's off script that sometimes he shows his age, shows some incapacity mentally, whatever it is. During the debate with Donald Trump, 51 million people saw what they saw, and they're not going to unsee it.
They're not going to unsee it. And we've had reaction from our listeners all around the world. So, for example, we have Cheleshe Mufulira from Zambia. He says, old age is a sign of wisdom. People should leave Biden alone. We also have another comment from a listener who didn't share their name, but he said, ever since the Democrats started tearing themselves to shreds over the suitability of President Biden to run for office, Trump's silence over the issue is becoming so loud that Americans are beginning to listen to it. What do you make of those points?
I'll be 76 in a couple of months, so I don't have any problem with old age whatsoever. I'm not even saying that an 81-year-old could not be president of the United States, but it's clear that, Mr. Biden has his difficulties. I don't know what the diagnoses are, but reporters have been talking about this, folks that meet with him have been talking about this for a while. And now, as the campaign heats up, everybody's getting to see it. In addition to that, he not only has a responsibility to himself and his own legacy, but he has a responsibility to try to win and try to do his best to help congressmen, U.S. senators who are in tight races win re-election. And you're hearing from these folks. Some have spoken up publicly, most notably Nancy Pelosi, the highly respected Democrat, former Speaker of the House, saying Mr. Biden needs to make a decision, and soon. And yet he's already made a decision, which he's saying, in effect, while the NATO leaders are here, is that I don't like that decision. You have to reconsider.
And John, you've been polling the American public for decades now. How do you think this is playing out with people on the ground?
Well, it's a very competitive race, but remember, it's competitive because Donald Trump is not a beloved figure. Yeah, 70% have said that they don't want either Biden or Trump as their candidates. Now, since the debate, 80% of voters are saying that they don't want Joe Biden in the race. That includes 44% of his own Democratic voters. Those are really compelling and troublesome numbers for the president. In this kind of instance, possible, probable diminished capacity, and yet a president who refuses to leave, this is something we've never seen before.
And what's your assessment of how this is going to play out in the months going ahead?
Well, the Democrats are going to need a new face. And, you know, Mr. Biden, ironically, has a strong domestic record to run on. It's just that he can't seem to make the case and get through this noise. And secondly, this issue of diminished capacity is just going to continue with him. Here we are tonight. We're talking about, what about his performance tomorrow? Do you think he'll rise to the occasion? We're going to have that same conversation in October.
Perhaps so you think he needs to just step aside?
I believe the numbers warrant it. And I think that actually that's going to happen.
US pollster and author John Zogby. Now, we've all been there. The train breaks down, the bus is late, your car gets a puncture. Spare a thought, though, for Sunita Williams and Barry Wilmore. It was on June the 5th that they blasted off for what was supposed to be an 8-day trip to the International Space Station. But the spacecraft which brought them there, made by Boeing, seems to have developed some faults. So they've been stuck up in orbit ever since, and they've given their first news conference. Our reporter Anna Aslam was watching.
Sunita Williams and Barry Wilmore are the first astronauts to fly Boeing's Starliner spaceship, but the dream is quickly becoming a nightmare. They've been at the International Space Station for more than a month now, after their return was pushed back because of thruster malfunctions and helium leaks. Speaking from the ISS, the pair said they had full faith Starliner would bring them home.
We're absolutely confident. We are actually doing thruster testing as we speak, and we are going to learn from that. But right now, based on what we know, we are absolutely ready.
I feel confident that if we had to, if there was a problem with the International Space Station, we can get in our spacecraft, undock, talk to our team, and figure out the best way to come home.
Williams and Wilmore said they were keeping busy doing experiments and were enjoying floating around. But back down on Earth, NASA and Boeing are in a less jovial mood. Engineers are working around the clock to diagnose and solve Starliner's problems. NASA's Steve Stitch said they were working to a tight schedule to avoid overcrowding at the space station. He said the astronauts would be brought home as soon as possible.
I think some of the data suggests optimistically maybe it's by the end of July. But, you know, the big driver is the handover that we have coming up between Crew 8 and Crew 9. which is in mid-August.
NASA and Boeing in particular have repeatedly said Williams and Wilmore aren't stuck or stranded in space. The Starliner can remain docked at the ISS for 45 days, and engineers are working on extending its battery life. If it still doesn't work, the astronauts can hitch a lift with other crews up there. But after years of delay and more than $1 billion over budget, Starliner was meant to be a big win for Boeing as it faces a safety crisis over its airplanes. It would be humiliating if the astronauts Boeing put in orbit have to be brought back home by Russia or SpaceX. Of course, if Starliner does manage to complete its mission, it'll be one step closer to becoming a routine mode of transport for NASA, although astronauts may overpack for future flights just in case.
Anna Aslam. Now, with its catchy melodies, polished dance routines and stylish music videos, K-pop has transformed from a South Korean musical subculture to a global phenomenon. However, the industry has now become divided over the issue of artificial intelligence. Seventeen, which I'm sure you are aware is a leading K-pop band, is among a growing number using AI to create music videos and write lyrics, Ella Bicknell reports.
South Korea likes to be on the forefront when it comes to technological innovation, and its music industry is no exception. That's Seventeen, one of the biggest acts in K-pop. Last year, their albums sold 16 million copies worldwide. The music video for their most recent single, Maestro, features an AI-generated scene, and one of the band members, Wheezy, has hinted artificial intelligence was used to write some of the lyrics. He said he was experimenting because he wanted to develop alongside the technology rather than complain about it. Megan Lawson is an entertainment journalist. She says many artists are feeling the same.
This is a real marked change from previous use of AI in K-pop, where it used to be a case of fans using it to make AI covers, you know, getting their favourite songs to be revoiced in the style of other singers. Those videos perform incredibly well on YouTube, and you have to think, okay, if K-pop artists thought, well, their videos are doing well, should we give it a go as well now?
It seems more and more bands are jumping on the AI bandwagon. Girl group Aespa used AI in their latest music video, which surpassed 10 million views within 10 hours of its launch. But how is this going down with fans? Some have embraced the move, but others say it compromises the connection they have with their favourite artists. Ashley Peralta presents a K-pop fan podcast from the Philippines.
The thing with K-pop fans, they love it when the music is a reflection of the artist. Very hands-on with the creative process, like they're choreographing their own pieces, they are composing and producing, and you get a piece of their feelings into that song. So when it comes to AI, it takes that very crucial component that connects fans to the artist away.
And it's not just an issue in K-pop. Just last month, some of the world's biggest artists, including Billie Eilish and Nicki Minaj, wrote an open letter calling for an end to what they call the predatory use of AI in the music industry. They say a lack of regulation could undermine the human artistry of songwriters and stop them getting fair compensation for their work. To quote some of the lyrics in 17's single, Good Life, We Go Global, always following the maestro's lead. If that's the case, the integration of AI in K-pop is no longer a question of if, but when.
Seventeen, ending that report from Ella Bicknell. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sydney Dundon. The producer was David Lewis. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the surprise election result in France that has put left-wing coalition, the New Popular Front, on top. So who are the left leaders? What do they want? And what does this result mean for French President Emmanuel Macron? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.